brothers and you, so. But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me. It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face. And you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies. I remember when I was with Special Forces. Seems 1,000 centuries ago. We went into a camp to inoculate some children. We left the camp after we had inoculated the children for polio. And this old man came running after us and he was crying. He couldn't say. We went back there and they had come and hacked off every inoculated arm. There they were in a pile. Pile of little arms. And I remember I cried, I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot. Like I was shot with a diamond. A diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius, the will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than we because they could stand it. These were not monsters. These were men, trained cadres. These men who fought with their hearts. Who have families, who have children, who are filled with love. But they had the strength. The strength. To do that. If I had 10 divisions of those men, then our troubles here would be over very quickly. You have to have men who are moral, and at the same time who are able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment, without judgment. Because it's judgment that defeats us.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. Hey, White Aryan Resistance calling. Tom Metzger. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, where it is snowy, 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 but a bright sun in the sky, so it's a nice day. Hey, this is the January the 13th, 2015. Thursday. Yeah. I always remember this day because my trash man comes today. and my dogs go crazy. Looks like we got another cold front coming in. It's supposed to go down to 10 below zero. How about that? I think I'll get on my horse and head for Southern Climbs, man. Don't forget, it's time to get your donations in for January if you haven't done it. Send them to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Send your snail mail there also. And we'll take it from there. And remember, if you have any kind of problems getting this show or anything like that, contact merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. Well, I'm going to do something I usually don't do. I'm going to run a program from another party. My old friend Wolf Wall Street, who's doing his own show and doing a good job on it. But he had a show on the 11th of January that talked about a lot about my history, and it's pretty straight. I went to California by myself. I had gone to California earlier on a vacation with my buddies and came back and quit my job and loaded up my Austin Healey and away I went. And other than a few errors, I got, I think it was 60,000 votes for Congress. I got 80,000 votes for U.S. Senate, which I, considering the situation and the adverse, total adverse anti-publicity from all the media and both parties, I thought was pretty good. Yeah, I met a lot of interesting people. I was made some pretty lucrative offers, which I refused, from both sides. And that's probably the reason I'm still the lonely Linwood Ford dealer out here at a little house in Indiana. But that's okay. I sleep good at nights. Yeah, one other thing. Bob Miles was not Christian Identity. He was a dualist. I'm not going to get into that. You could probably get it off Wikipedia, but he believed in dualism. However, he ran with CI people for years, and there were all kinds of CI people went to his gatherings once a year at his ranch or farm up in Michigan. Anyhow, I'm going to run this for you because he did a pretty damn good job, and we'll go from there. One other thing, that was John Schmitz, Congressman John Schmitz, who was a longtime congressman from Orange County and a friend of mine, and his wife was a casual friend of mine, and his son was a friend of mine, and so forth. And of course, then I did run the George Wallace for President campaign headquarters in Southern California and Fallbrook, California. The night of the election with John Schmitz, he had his get-together at the Disneyland Hotel. And that's when I first introduced videotape. Videotape, the first machines were reel-to-reel, like an audio reel-to-reel. And so it was pretty new stuff. And so I volunteered to cover that. Oh, yes, one other thing. Yeah, I was a fan of Route 66. In fact, I knew Marty Milner later when I moved to California. I've been in his home several times. Of course, probably most people out there don't remember who Marty Milner was. I'm not sure what he's doing now. He's getting up there. Anyhow, yeah, it was 61 is when I left for California in my little sports car. About 2 feet of snow on the ground here in Indiana when I left. And I did go out there and went to work for Douglas Aircraft in the missile division. And like that, so, like I say, other than a few points, it's pretty close. Thank you.
Good morning out there. This is Wolf Wall Street with the Fourth Position Show. The Church of Now, the Warrian Church of Now, here on Sunday morning, the 11th of January, 2015. The name of this show, or the title, the top billing there, is The Metzger Path. And I'm going to put into the chat the link to my blog, which explains a little bit more about it. And there it is. Folks can go there and check it out. Now, I call it the Metzger Path, and the reason I do is Tom Metzger is a good representation of what everybody goes through, or most everybody goes through, unless they're just brought up in it and, you know, brought up in power and learn things. But he's a good example of what everybody goes through to some degree. He started out as pretty much a farm boy in Indiana, or closely related to that. He did work around farms. He worked at farms. I don't know if his home life was totally dedicated to farming or if it was a combination, which often happens in the Corn Belt area. But he started out that way. In high school, he became interested in ham radio, became very good at it, and then he went into the military and eventually got into microwave and things like that in the military. One other thing happened when he went into the military is he became racially aware of just what the blacks are all about. He had no idea until he went into the military. So it's a good example of how a guy can come from off the farm, not naive, but just inexperienced, and end up being one of the top white leaders in American history in the 20th century. So it's something that we should learn from. So that's why I brought it up. Now, over at the blog, you'll see that I show the Route 66 television program and a map there showing Route 66. That's actually a license plate that people sell. And the series itself was about 4 or 5 years long, and they went through different combinations and permutations, different episodes. But it's interesting that in the second year of the series, in 1961, they did one where Buzz and Todd ended up in the San Diego area working in the aerospace industry, but they didn't get married and stop there. The series had to go on. The episodes had to continue, but that really does show what Tom Metzger did with a friend of his. He went into the area and married, had a big family, and I think his friend did too, that he went out there with. So it almost, you know, who knows? I don't know what time Tom went out there, the exact times, but I doubt if anybody would script a show based on Tom Metzger's early exploits, but the parallels are very, very interesting there. So, look at the space cadets. Anyway, so Tom got out there. He got into the aerospace industry in the San Diego area, and that industry is part of the MIC, the Military Industrial Complex, so they would try and get their employees involved into the right-wing aspects of America. So they would bring in films probably by the John Birch Society or similar places like that, and Tom got into it. And he became a John Birch Society member. He stayed a member for quite a while, and he got into politics also. Now, the exact timing of all these things I don't want to go into because I don't really know. I didn't review that aspect of it, but I just want to give you what it appears to me, just remembering, is that so he got into the John Birch Society, he got involved in politics, I think he ran for a few local offices, then he probably supported George Wallace in the late 60s, that's very likely. I know he supported one fella in 1972 for the presidential run, and I can't remember the guy's name right now, but I'll put it in the chat later if I happen to remember. But this fella was pretty well known, very well known, and he supported him. And at the same time, he started a border patrol. Right in early to mid-70s, he started a border patrol, which was to at least bring forward the problem of this invasion of illegal aliens. Now, this is over 40 years ago Tom's doing this stuff. People are still harping about it now and doing absolutely nothing. And Tom Metzger was fighting the good fight over 40 years ago. Around the same time, David Duke took notice, and somehow they got together, and Tom got into the Klan. So eventually Tom became the head of the Klan in California, the big grand poobah, whatever they call it. So I don't want to get into that too much, but I do want to let you know that there's a progression here. While this is going on, Tom got married. I don't know if he wants to. He's said this publicly, so I don't think it's a problem. The wonderful lady he married was a relation to Eva Braun. And so all Tom Metzger's children are related to Eva Braun. Isn't that interesting? At the same time, so he's married. She happened to be Catholic. So his first, outside of probable Protestant, some kind of Protestant church stuff back in Indiana, which I don't know the specifics, but most likely that was the case, he became a Catholic once he married a Catholic, a Roman Catholic. So here's Tom Metzger. He goes from farm boy, doesn't know anything about blacks, learns about blacks, doesn't know much about politics, but gets into an MIC company, learns about the John Birch Society, becomes a right-winger, and doesn't know much about Roman Catholicism, marries a Catholic, becomes a Catholic. And then, from that, he eventually became a CI, not just a CI convert, but he actually became a minister in the CI movement, Christian Identity. And I think he married some people as a CI minister. Isn't that interesting? And after that, in that period, we're talking in the 70s now, going into the early 80s, he ran for Congress, for representative for Orange County in California, and that's San Diego area. I'm pretty sure it was Orange County. It might have been a different county, but I'm pretty sure it was Orange County. And he ran as a Democrat, and he snuck in there, and he got the nomination. That was national and international news for the whole year, even though he got the minimal amount of votes because the Democrats obviously weren't going to vote for him, and the scum Republicans, the Repugs, told their people to vote for the Democrat. But the thing is, he got in there. At that time, I don't know, right around that time, he gave up his Klan, he gave up his CI thinking, his religious thinking, became an atheist in his terms, someplace in that era, going into the 80s, and that's leading up to where he is now, but there's a little bit more to it. He ran for the, and lost, but he did run. He was the Democratic nominee for Congress in 1980, and I'm pretty sure it was Orange County, or that district was pretty much Orange County and a few other places, the most important district in the country. Believe me, that was international news. And so lost that, and 2 years later, 1982, he ran for Senate, but didn't get any place on that, but, you know, made the showing. Interestingly, some people told him that if he happened to win in 1980 as a representative, they would have killed him. So along that line, too, Governor Pat Brown of California at that time, he wanted Tom to come on board with the more progressive side, and I mean progressive in a pretty good way, side of the Democratic Party. They were industrialist people like that. He wanted Tom to come on board. He saw that Tom was a great leader. But Tom, you know, he could see through all the bullshit, and he wouldn't do it. His morality is too far up there, his ethics and morality. So he didn't do that. Then he becomes an atheist. He gives up the CI, and then you have white Aryan resistance. So with the white Aryan resistance, Tom came into contact. I don't know, it probably was audio. I don't know if you ever met him, but Ian Stewart? I forget his name. He was a big-time English guy that had the group Screwdriver and the skinhead movement in general. That was, Tom, in the early to mid-80s. White Aryan Resistance, it is Ian Stewart. Thank you, Nazi Identity 1488. That's what I thought. I think his last name is McDonald, but that's the name he goes by, or he went by. So, the screwdriver, the skinhead movement, the heavy metal, the white power metal of the early to mid-80s, going into the late 80s, Tom was the head of that movement. In fact, the book or the movie that starred Ed Norton was a skinhead movie. They used some of Tom Metzger as expert background, and I think he got paid for that, too. There it is, MVH, My Violent Heart, says American History X. That's the one. So Tom was an advisor on that movie. I don't know if he should have done it because of the ending, but some parts of it are kind of cool. I stay away from Curbs. So Tom is in the middle of the skinhead movement. Then toward the end, oh, by the way, all this time, Tom is developing a relationship with Louis Beam as far as the lone wolf and small cell idea, because he could see that we were behind the eight ball, so to speak. We were weak in numbers. We were really enemies behind the lines, considering that the Kite Jews took over America no later than the 60s. And so he was beginning to realize this. So all along this time, he's also promoting the idea of the lone wolf small cell and not to join membership organizations, etc. So that, too, was happening. These are all parallel things happening. But the idea, I'll interrupt this right now, this sort of a mini history, the idea is that he was going through these stages. Here he's a farm boy, then, you know, he learns about blacks, then he gets into the right wing, and it's really a gatekeeper right wing, but he got into that. Then, et cetera, et cetera. He goes down the line, even becomes a CI minister. Isn't that interesting? I want to stress that at the end, I'm going to point out something very salient about all this, but I don't want to do it right now. But stick around for the end, because I think there is something salient to be said. Now, through the 80s, I think Tom met Bob Matthews more than a few times, and I know he met him a few times, but I think he met him more than a few times, but maybe not. But enough so that he could see that Bob Matthews was a great leader. And so they got taken down. The order got taken down in 1984, and then there was a big trial in 1985, and Tom was there supporting them all the way. And there were only three top-level people, at least that I know of. I think there were a few more, but really very few people on the right supported the order. And these were the ones that survived that were on trial at that time. There was Tom Metzger. There was Pastor Bob Miles, who was still CI right to the end, but a great guy, and Pastor Butler. Pastor Butler was CI also right to the end. You know, these are great guys. These are people that will stand for you no matter what. Dangerous or not, it don't matter. They're going to do it. And by the way, Bob Miles, Pastor Bob Miles, has one of the best statements ever. We march separately, but we will strike together. And this also will make the ending of the show more succinct. So, those three were supporting the order and the idea of the order. But Tom was realizing, along with Louis Beam, that we got to be lone wolf. We can't join membership organizations. They're all infiltrated, and et cetera, et cetera. And then near the end of the 80s, he got taken down by the SPLC. And this guy, Dees, with a bunch of lies, but he even says, looking back, or he said, looking back at it, that he should have never even appeared in court. Should have never even given him their day, because the police lied, the prosecutors lied, Dees always lies, and he's a pedophile anyway. Folks that don't believe that can go check out his divorce papers. This piece of crap is a pedophile. Tom got taken to the cleaners there, and he lost his business. And people say that he's still paying for that. It's bullshit. But there are detractors out there who are either paid by the people like the JIDF or probably the SPLC and Dees, people like that, or they're just assholes that don't understand Tom. But no, he's not paying that shit. And there are detractors out there. I won't even go into who they are, but they're just lower than scum, that's for sure. So Tom went into the 90s with the whole concept of definitely skinhead, start growing back your hair, start infiltrating, become ghost wolves, get into the normal flow of things. It's the only way to beat these people. The Gramsci method that the Kike Jews and Jew thinkers on the left use to infiltrate the institutions, the march through the institutions, Tom was telling our people to do, and this is 25 years ago he began, for sure. I think even before that. So Tom came through the 90s and then into the new century, and he became the insurgent. Rather than war, the White Aryan Resistance, which had been his organization for 20 years, he became the insurgent, and his radio show became more and more dominant, his internet radio show became more and more dominant. That was his daily show, except for Sundays and that kind of thing. So, and that's what he's doing now. However, just recently, he has gone back to using the idea of White Aryan Resistance, which I think is a good one. It's a great logo. War, White Aryan Resistance is a great logo. So I forgot to mention that earlier in the 60s, Tom Metzger joined the anti-war movement from the right. He would not pay taxes and almost lost his house because of it. And there aren't too many people that did that on the right, if any. So this guy's got a lot of aspects on him that are positives. Nowadays, as I said, he's back doing White Aryan Resistance, and he's a venerable white leader, and he should be honored as such. Okay, so there's Tom Metzger. He's done just about everything in his life, and a lot of people would kind of question, what in the hell happened there? I mean, sure, he was a farm boy Protestant. Who knows what that was all about? But what the hell is this stuff about him being a Roman Catholic for a while? And then a Christian identity. I think he was a minister. I'm pretty sure he was. I'm pretty sure he even officiated at some weddings. You know, we've got some people these days that if the shit were to hit the fan now, and it was back then when Tom Metzger was a CI guy or even a Roman Catholic, they'd want to blow his brains out. You know that? There are some people out there that would want to blow his brains out. Tom Metzger. Our people, supposedly. Now, my point is, we are all on a path. That's the name of today's show. The Metzger Path. Tom Metzger's Path. Just as an example. I did sort of a bowdlerized job explaining it, but I think you get the point. We're all on a path, and we're developing ourselves, which is the way it should be done. And if we take these hard stances, these doctrinaire stances, all the time, every time, without using our reasoning ability to determine when to do what, just broad brushing, well, that kind of a broad brush reminds me of cultural Marxism. It reminds me of cultural Marxism. The broad brushing, doctrinaire aspect to take things treats them as equal. That's cultural Marxism, or pretty goddamn close to it. So we got to think about that. Folks that really hate Christianity and hate CI would have killed Tom Metzger in midstream if they had the chance. And a lot of other people are still in that path, that same path. How far along are they? I don't know. Some will never get there. Some get stuck and stay with the wrong thing forever and a day. Well, they're part of the 80%. But most people are in the 20% on that path, that progress, and many don't make it out, but some are in the left. They're in the left, but they'll come our way. They will. That's what Tom was always after. He was telling people, hey, go to the left. Usually smarter people there, too, although I don't believe that, but sometimes it appears that way. But everybody's on a path. And if we get stuck in doctrinaire thinking, broad brushing, we become cultural Marxists. We believe in equality. It's bullshit. So, that's the bottom line point I wanted to make with the show today. Now, I think there are some other aspects to it that I want to bring up. Let's suppose you are doctrinaire in that way, though. just 100% against, let's say, Christianity, not making any differentiation, Orthodox, this, that, or the other thing. You have to admit that there are a lot of these crazy Christian Zionists that the Jews, they may not love them up close, but they love the fact that they're on their side, they're giving them money, they're just complete assholes for the Jews. So the Jews love them. Now, if your idea when the shit hits the fan is to whack those people, I mean, what's the problem? I see no problem. But then you've got these other types that absolutely hate Jews. They love their ethnicity, if not putting it in the same words of loving the white race, but they love their white ethnicity. And you'd kill them as well as you'd kill one of these other types. Now, what the fuck are you thinking about? What the fuck are you thinking about? What the fuck are you thinking about? At the very least, adjust your thinking and put these Christians that hate Jews, love their ethnicities, on the back burner. And in America, for example, take care of the 80 million Christian Zionists first. Now, as far as church burnings go, I know Varg burnt some churches up there in Sweden or Norway, someplace up there in Scandinavia, and other people did it too. You know, if you're espousing church burning, I'm not going to go one way or the other, and if it's a Christian Zionist church, I don't give a damn. But realistically, if you're going to espouse that in a broad-brushing method, then start with the goddamn Notre Dame Cathedral and take out that Gothic cathedral in Cologne. Start taking them down brick by brick. So I'll just leave it at that. That's pretty much all I have to say today, and I'm going to check my notes, though. Maybe I do have something else. There is news. There is news out there about this Khazarian thing, this concept that I put out a few years back. Now it's coming true. I don't know if you folks have heard of this Chabad Lubavitcher, quote, Messiah, end quote, that died a while back. They think he's going to come back to life. I mean, these people are fucking as wacky as you can get. This guy, interestingly, was born in Ukraine. Not only was he born in Ukraine, but he was born in Dnipropetrovsk, which is where Kolomoisky, the Kite Jew who runs a lot of their mercenary operations for the Jews, and he's a Kite Jew, and he runs them for the government, the Kiev Junta, which is totally Kite Jew controlled.
Oh, there we go. That was a little show from Wolf Wall Street. He still has his show on Sunday. And we are 6 days a week. Yo, I'll be back in a second. Well, I was thumbing around through the media like I do 24/7. I took a little clip out here, a book called The Amateur about Obama. And the man's name that wrote it's Klein. He's very likely Jewish. He was the chairman or big shot in the New York Times magazine for 14 years. And he's written this book about Obama. I just took a short clip out of it just to let you know what you probably already know or with suspicion. He reminds me of a couple of, well, at least one right-winger that I know.
Feels hurt and bitter that he was thrown under the bus, as he sees it, by Barack Obama and the Obama campaign during 2008. He felt that he had a special relationship with Obama that went on for 23 years. It is a mistake to think that Barack Obama only knew Jeremiah Wright through sitting in a pew in his church and listening to these sermons. In fact, Barack Obama and Jeremiah Wright had a one-on-one relationship in which they met for literally hundreds of times in the Reverend Wright's home. And at every step of Obama's career, he went to the Reverend Wright for advice, counsel, political direction. So this was a relationship that was closer than any relationship in his life, with the possible exception of his relationship with his own wife, Michelle Obama.
Mr. Klein, does he have any contact right now with the president?
No, there's no contact. after Obama won the presidency, the Reverend Wright told me that he sent him a note congratulating him on achieving his ambition, as he put it, and that he didn't expect the note to get to him directly, so he gave it to a neighbor of Obama's, who the Reverend Wright knew, to hand deliver it. And he doesn't know to this day whether that note was ever delivered.
Who is Steve Rogers, who you also interview in here?
Steve Rogers.
From Chicago.
Steve Rogers is a professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
And what was his connection with President Obama?
Like many African-American businessmen and leaders that whom I interviewed, he was an early backer and supporter of Obama. After Obama lost a congressional primary to Bobby Rush in 2000, Rush is a former Black Panther, but now a congressman, he was deeply in debt, and he went around looking for people to donate money to his cause. And Steve Rogers, very successful businessman at that time, before he became a professor, gave him, I believe it was $6,000, to pay off some of his personal debts. In return, Obama promised that he would visit Steve Rogers' students, and if he won the U.S. Senate seat, and speak to them. Well, he did win the U.S. Senate seat. Rogers never heard from him, so he called him up and he asked Obama, would he come? And Obama said, you know, Steve, I'm too busy. I'm getting phone calls from Warren Buffett and from Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and, you know, all these important people. And Rogers said, but you promised. And Obama told him, well, you know, Steve, you're not supposed to believe promises made by politicians, are you? And Rogers got very angry and demanded that he show up. And eventually he did show up, Obama. But the point of the story is that so many of the African-American leaders, businessmen, and political people that I've spoken to for this book told me similar stories in which they were there for him, for Obama, day one. They were what they call day one people, supporting him, organizing for him, contributing to him, and that once he was elected to either the Senate and then eventually to the presidency, they never heard again from him. There was a lack of gratitude, a lack of sense of obligation. And it wasn't only African Americans. It was also Jewish American donors who gave him vast sums of money and never got their phone calls returned. It was Oprah Winfrey who worked hard for him and then was frozen out of the White House, and Caroline Kennedy, and on and on and on. So the portrait that I derived from all this was that here was a president who, or a man who felt that he deserved, he was entitled to all this support and didn't owe anything back in return.
Hey, boys and girls, it doesn't make any difference what color they are. Really. They're all rats. They cannot get to that position of power without being rats. I was amused when Klein said that, well, the one president that didn't do all this kind of stuff was Eisenhower. Well, Eisenhower is responsible for so many deaths, it's unbelievable. Even after the Germans surrendered, deprived them of food, allowed them to live in the open terrain, digging holes in the ground to survive. He was a war criminal, no doubt about it. So all you got left is little old me. And I'm not running for office. Right. But you know that old saying, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. That's bullshit. I mean, other than a very tiny percentage, you could lie to them, cheat them, screw them, kill them, tax them, throw them in the army, throw them in the... You can do anything to them. Yep. I think it was somebody who sent me a story about this good-looking white woman that was bringing her trash cans in, and the niggers got her, killed her. And what a terrible thing this was. Well, you know, I'm sort of out of that stuff, because after being in some court trials and seeing how these juries operate and seeing how white middle class, upper middle class, wealthy whites act on a jury, I reserve my compassion completely for somebody I really know. Yep, I'm sorry, but this stuff of crying crocodile tears every time a white woman gets killed or a white guy gets killed, I'd bet you $100 if you had were charged with some kind of crime and they were on the jury, they'd sell you out. They'd find you guilty, and they'd be thrilled you'd go to prison for 50 years. So I say quit feeling so damn sorry about white people in general. They've had it coming, now they're getting it. Well, we got some mail in today. Got one from Maine in here. Yeah. Got one from Virginia. Got one from California. Got one from England. Got one from another one from New York. And let's see, what's this last one? Oh, that was from Rhode Island, and he put some extra in there for the POWs. Thank all you guys. Appreciate it. And here's a note from one of the boys. TT, I was listening to your radio show on the book Hitler, the Founder of Israel. It explains a lot. I ordered a copy myself. During the early days of the war between 39 and 41, he was handed victory on a silver platter at least four times. First at Dunkirk, he left the British army escape across the English Channel, 300,000 of England's most experienced soldiers. As Bevan Alexander points out in his book Inside the Nazi War Machine, if the Germans would have finished the job at Dunkirk, there probably would not have not had to invade Russia, because Stalin and the communist regime probably would have done anything to placate him. They missed a major opportunity in the North African desert when Erwin Rommel chased the British across the North African into Tobruk. German Navy Admiral Erich Raeder wanted to give Rommel more panzer divisions to take out the Suez Canal, where British oil supplies were. And instead of using the Luftwaffe paratroopers to take out Crete, he wanted to take out Malta, where the British destroyers were sinking Germans and Italian merchant shipping. Ironically, even the Italian naval staff was on board with this. They understood the strategy. England would have been out of the war, and I doubt Russia would have invaded Germany. And many white lives would have been saved from this carnage. As always, your radio shows are very informative, and I start to understand things are more complicated than what I was led to believe. Keep up the good work. Wolf, New York. How about that? Well, thank you. Well, let's check in on Slapsy Maxi here. Kaiser, let's find out who's screwing us economically. And what's up in China, Max?
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Meet the New World Order. Same as the Old World Order. Stacy?
Yes, Max. Well, our first headline is from Liam Halligan, a year marking a return to the Old World Order. So he was asked, he was writing about his, what was the most significant geopolitical event of 2014, and he says it was when China passed the U.S. in 2014 to be the world's largest economy. In 1980, China's annual economic output was just one-tenth of that of America's. As recently as 2004, the Chinese economy was only half of that of the U.S. In October, though, the International Monetary Fund quietly published estimates showing China's annual GDP at $17.6 trillion compared with $17.4 trillion in the U.S. But the U.S. obviously remains richer per head, but the Chinese are gaining. And this is on purchasing power parity.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting is that you go back a few thousand years and the dominant economy historically has been China. So they are reassuming the mantle of world-leading economy. The U.S. was an upstart. It had its day, but now it's kind of like also ran.
Yeah, you know, speaking of the past few thousand years, I saw something in the past week where Ambrose Evans Pritchard was noting that yields on sovereign bonds are back to the days of the Black Plague sort of days. And Europe, you know, they're contemplating the Grexit. This seems like Greece might exit the Eurozone, and it seems to be going back to the same sort of time of the, you know, the Dark Ages in Europe, perhaps.
Right, like during the bubonic plague, the price of, I don't know, garlic or something probably hit new all-time highs as a desperate measure to fend off the ravages of the Black Plague. And here we are in 2014, and people are buying bonds, sovereign bonds, in a desperate attempt to stave off collapse. And, of course, it won't work.
And the other thing is that since the early 80s, Chinese GDP has been growing about 9.8% per year compared with 2.7% in the U.S. So it's just been growing at leaps and bounds. And then having said that, Liam says, while the developed economies are set to grow by 2.4% on average in 2015, according to a new HSBC report, the emerging markets are on course to expand by 4.1%. More importantly, Western growth is still far too heavily dependent on rising indebtedness, virtually printed money, and hype. Many of the large emerging markets continue, in contrast, to ride a mega trend of rapid industrialization, urbanization, and population growth, like the likes of which the West hasn't seen for generations. So none of it is debt-fueled, or much less of it is anyway, in the emerging markets compared to here, where our GDPs only rise if our debt rises.
Well, you know, Richard Nixon went to China and he opened China up, and the idea was, you know, we want China back on the world stage, and with a competitive economy, trade is good, let's bring China back. And then they were admitted to the World Trade Organization, and okay, let's do trade. But then the U.S. decided to export most of its manufacturing jobs to China, and that's where things went pear-shaped for the United States, because they didn't bring in a consumer. They brought in a low-cost labor supplier that gutted the U.S. economy, and all those people that are buying Chinese goods at Walmart, of course, are doing so by going heavily into debt. And that debt, of course, is financed once again by China. So it's a heads I win, tails you lose. China wins. Open Confucius very famously said this.
In fact, Liam Halligan does go into this, you know, many of the emerging markets now looking at the China model as a way forward for them, that they don't need the same sort of democracy as it were in America. But he thinks that might be a mistake. But in terms of that, at least China does have five-year plans and 10-year plans. In America, of course, we only have quarterly earnings. That's everybody's concerned about what the stock price is doing that day or the next day. And that's allowed for people to not have a plan for what happens to the economy when people don't have jobs, when they don't create wealth.
Well, having just come back from Hong Kong, what I noticed is that it's a society that you could describe as being secular. And it used to be able to describe America like this. It's a secular society, but it's become a religious, theocratic, dictatorial nightmare, the United States, driven by agenda of those who are pursuing some kind of religious fanaticism compared to China, which is just a secular nation, like doing it, getting the job done. They, you know, they're not involved in all these petty squabbles.
So let's go back to what Liam Halligan is saying, is we're returning to the old world order. China has been at the top of the, has been the largest economy for most of the past few thousand years. And I just want to say for the 2015, a book that you must get is called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World by William J. Bernstein. It's something we read a few years ago. And it really does put into context not only the fact that free trade has been happening for thousands of years, but if you look back, it goes back to 3000 BC, and you see the Chinese were at the top of the game way back then, getting on ships tied together with rope and traveling to Africa around the Horn of India. You know, it was just, it's been like that for thousands of years without any sort of ideology or economic theory or anything. People just do.
Yeah, driven by trade. And this is a lesson that America somehow lost along the way. They don't really believe in trade as a way to grow an economy anymore. They believe in the sanctity of the central bank and that they can grow their economy by printing money, which is ironic given that Chinese invented paper money.
Okay, so the U.S. was the number one economy from 1872 when it took over Britain. And I want to turn to what's happening in the U.K., because, of course, we saw, you know, everybody saying that the economy is recovering because GDP was growing because spending was up. Well, warning over UK consumers running up highest levels of debt since the credit crunch after borrowing levels hit £1.25 billion for November. That was just the unsecured borrowing levels, £1.25 billion, which was the highest since February 2008 when Northern Rock collapsed and the beginning of the credit crunch getting really funky. And statistics released yesterday showed that more than $980 million was taken out in loans and overdrafts during November, a sharp rise from the average of $728 million in the 6 months before. Experts said the surge in retail sales around Black Friday, when an estimated £8.10 million was spent online, was probably linked to the increase in borrowing. So it's almost one for one. Every single bit of money that we celebrated being spent online was due to unsecured debt.
Another example of an economy that believes growth is tied to borrowing and financed by printing money. And the result is that you've got an incredibly indebted country where the manufacturing base has been obliterated. And in the UK, Osborne has added close to £1 trillion in debt since he took over the chancellor position. The deficit is still close to £100 billion, and they made a few cuts, but they got the easy cuts out of the way. Now, over the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to add another £100 billion in debt again. So the deficit will go back right up back to 10-11% of GDP, mark my words.
So the statistics also show that consumers have borrowed more than they have paid off almost every month since September 2012. And I want to turn to the headline about the Conservative Party poster, which is also very similar in with like the whole trickle down of never paying off your debts. Conservative election poster, Tories use picture of German road in road to recovery election poster. So let's look at their poster, and it says, let's stay on the road to a stronger economy, 1.75 million more people in work, 760,000 more businesses, the deficit halved. Of course, they are counting on the population thinking that the deficit equals debt, but the debt continues to grow because they still have a deficit. So this is the same thing that a lot of consumers, the mentality of the population here in the United Kingdom thinks, well, my interest rates on my loan, on my mortgage went halved, and therefore I can continue to add more and more and ever more piles of debt.
Okay, so it could be a poster for, you know, the new remake of The Wizard of Oz, where we follow the credit card road. Follow the credit card road. Follow the credit card road. Something like that. With, you know, munchkins, flying monkeys.
Are you talking about Tony Blair there or Gordon Brown?
The whole front bench, bunch of flying monkeys.
The interesting thing, too, is that that road was all cracked in the real, they photoshopped it, but it was from Weimar, Germany.
So, of course.
So it makes sense, of course. Also, the interesting thing was that some conservatives leapt to the defense of the merits of this poster. MEP Daniel Hannan, for example, tweeted, so what if the photograph was taken in Germany? A reminder that our economy is set to overtake theirs in 25 years.
Well, they make three central claims in that poster, all of which are counterfactual.
Mm-hmm.
The deficit, the jobs, and some other number that they quote, they're all completely lies. They're not true. So yes. it's a poster full of lies. I think that's the first point that needs to be made.
A poster full of lies, yes. And we've covered, of course, the fact that all these new businesses and all these people in work are actually self-employed, making less than 10,000 pounds a year, so contributing nothing to the economy. And it's actually a way, apparently, that the unemployment benefits office is forcing these people, pushing them onto this, declaring themselves self-employed, because apparently you get more benefits that way. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, the claims made in this poster are fallacious. They're counterfactual. They're untrue. They're lies.
But also, so here, the UK apparently thinks they're going to overtake Germany in 25 years. It's always 25 years in the future. Someday in the future, if wishes were conditions, we'll all be fat. No, we'll all be German. We'll all be Chinese.
What will happen is that Germany will overtake the city of London, because as soon as the UK votes itself out of the EU, Frankfurt's going to take over all that business, and they'll be number one financial center of Europe, and the UK will drop to number 3, 4, or 7, whatever.
There has to be a way to combine China and Germany into that poster. So if you see the UK economy along the road in Weimar,
shoot
Germany.
No, that's something about, no, that's the Zen. That's right. You see the Buddha. I got those confused.
And then finally, bringing it back to the U.S., which is apparently the empire or the largest economy, now no longer the largest economy, it's the second largest economy, and that is peak dream, the death of the young entrepreneur. So the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the share of people under 30 who are own private business has reached a 24-year low. It's now, if you look at this chart, you'll see that there are fewer owners from 1989, when there were over 10% of under 30s were business owners, and to just 3.6% today. I think that's also a sign of less mom-and-pop businesses. Everything is like Walmart, huge families, and fewer people running their own businesses. So it's these multinationals with employees over in China and these giant...
Yeah, it could be. No, the high street's been changed dramatically, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You don't have the mom-and-pop anymore. It's all these huge chains. So true.
Well, you know as well as I do, or you should know, that there's no one thing or any two things that you and I can do about this. The empire is deteriorating. The problem with empires deteriorating is that they become far more dangerous when they're collapsing than when they're coming up, because above everything, they want to retain power. And considering the debt mess that they put everybody in in service of the ruling class, they're gonna lose it. And a lot of people say, oh well, it's a good thing that the feds are moving troops into Asia, bringing battleships over to Asia. Well, you know what that's all about. China's not going to march. China doesn't have to march. China's the kingpin in Asia, and they don't have to do anything. What they're putting all that military over there for is in case it gets real bad and the empire is crashing. Well, we've got an enemy. We can wage nuclear war and trounce them and get all the money back. That's all that's about. China's not about to go on an invasion mode. They've got it. They're sitting on top of the world, except for their environmental problems. And they do have major environmental problems. And they do have a few revolutionary whispers going on, some of the red units and individuals are coming together again in China. So they're over on one side chewing on the rug too, so it's going to be quite interesting. But as far as credit, see, the best weapon you have is to have no credit. That's what's killing you. That's what's killing the whole bit. So take that credit card and either cut it up, throw it away, or if you keep it, use it to make money. And I've told you that a long time ago. The Asians have learned that are living in this country. They get a few people together in their family, and they get these credit cards, and they, get several thousand dollars in credit. and they go out and they shop and they buy up cars and all kinds of things, you know, 50 cents on a dollar, maybe less. And then they turn around and sell that stuff right away to dumb Whitey. And when they do that, then it's they're making lots of money. You could have done that too. I know I've done it several times, and that's another way. But any kind of going into debt now is insane. I see on television this housing and real estate, and there's nothing less than $300,000. I mean, that they show on TV. Any halfway decent, nice place is over $200,000, and most of them starting a half a million. Now, can you imagine how silly it is for a young couple to saddle themselves with that much debt? They'll never pay it off, just like they'll never pay off their college bills for going to Harvard to learn bullshit and learn how to hate their race. Well, boys and girls, that's about it for today. I'm looking around here on my desk and I don't see anything more I need to talk about, but you can be sure I'll be back tomorrow to talk about and walk about 14:05. And remember, might is right. And if you don't have the power, you're not in control. So you better figure out a way to get the power or stay out of the road of power. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that book I was telling about, written by Klein. The guy was interviewing him, asked him about Michelle Obama, and he said, "Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful first lady we have." Now that Jew is a lying son of a bitch, and he knows it. If he says Michelle Obama is a beautiful, beautiful first lady, I almost puked in my coffee. One thing before I go, we need to say a couple of words about the cartoonist Robert Crumb, who lived in France since 1991. Robert Crumb is considered by many to be the single best cartoonist America ever produced. The creator of counterculture icons like Fritz the Cat, the Keep On Truckin' Guy, and Mr. Natural, Mr. Crumb was inducted into the Comic Book Hall of Fame in 1991. The same year he moved his family to France, where he has resided ever since. Writer Celia Farber reached him at his home on Friday, January 9th, to talk about the massacre of cartoonists and others in Paris this week. There's an article goes on. Oh, I thought he passed away. No, he's still alive and drawing, baby.
Tell the truth. Don't be bullshitting people. Like I say, there's enough bullshit as it is. In fact, there's just enough. Did you know that? There's just enough bullshit in this country to hold things together. Bullshit is the glue that binds us as a nation. Where would we be without our safe, familiar American bullshit? Land of the free, home of the brave, the American dream. All men are equal, justice is blind, the press is free, business is honest, the good guys win, your vote counts, the police are on your side, God is watching you, your standard of living will always improve, and everything is going to be just fine. The official national bullshit story. I call it the American okey-doke. Every one of those items is provably untrue at one level or another, but we believe them because they're pounded into our heads from the time we're children. That's what they do with that kind of thing. Pounded into the heads of kids because they know the children are much too young to be able to muster an intellectual defense against a sophisticated idea like that. And they know that up to a certain age, children believe everything their parents tell them. And as a result, they never learn to question things. Nobody questions things in this country anymore. Nobody questions anything. Everybody's too fat and happy. Everybody's got a cell phone that'll make pancakes and rub their balls now, you know? Way too fucking prosperous for our own good. Way too fucking prosperous. Americans have been bought off and silenced by toys and gizmos, and no one learns to question things. You remember? Like I say, no one questions things. You remember Barbara Bush? I call her the silver douchebag. You remember her? Barbara Bush. She is the mother of Governor George Bush. I call him Governor Bush because that's the only elected office he ever held legally in our country, okay? George Bush, Governor Bush. Yeah. I don't care where they hang his portrait. I don't care how big his library is. He'll always be Governor Bush. I don't even capitalize his name when I type it anymore. So she's the mother of Governor George Bush. She's also the wife of his father, George H.W. Bush, who did become president in the normal, legal, traditional manner. And when he did, she came along for the ride as first lady. And that's been the tradition up till now. A man has been elected, and the woman has come along for the ride as the first lady. And usually, as in American life in general, the woman is condescended to, patronized, given something to do to keep her busy. A lot of times they give her a charity or a cause, something she can champion. Betty Ford was told to drink. Remember that? Yeah, remember that? That's right. Betty Ford was told, you drink, Betty. Betty, you drink and get really fucked up, okay? Just get totally fallen down, fucked up, drunk, shit-faced, and blow your liver out. Blow your fucking liver out, honey. Then we'll hose you down and we'll put you in a place and get you well there and put your name on the place and Liza Minnelli can get well and everything's going to be okay. You know what I mean? So, that was her assignment. That was her assignment. Barbara Bush's assignment was getting children to read. Remember that? Getting children to read. They figured she had had so much success with George. That she would be a natural to get children to read, which misses the point completely. Not important to get children to read. Children who want to read are going to read. Kids who want to learn to read are going to learn to read. Much more important to teach children to question what they read. Children should be taught to question everything, to question everything they read, everything they hear. Children should be taught to question authority. Parents never teach their children to question authority because parents are authority figures themselves, and they don't want to undermine their own bullshit inside the household. So they stroke the kid, and the kid strokes them, and they all stroke each other, and they all grow up all fucked up, and they come to shows like this.